organizers for this opportunity to speak here. So my goal is indeed to review some very recent progress on some aspects of quantum field theory and the renormalization group flow. So I'll start with some preemptive measures so that we're all on the same page, and to make sure that everybody knows that quantum field theory, whatever it is, and we're going to discuss some aspects of it today, it definitely works. So this is an example of some, this is a compilation of some precision measurements from LEP from roughly 15 years ago or 10 years ago. So these are many, many precision measurements that were done in this in LEP. And you see here the standard model predicted value, though these values are calculated with the tools of quantum field theory. And here you can see what's been actually measured. And the final column here is the deviations measured in the number of sigmas. So you see that essentially there were roughly 25 measurements, and they're all within two sigmas from the standard model, except for one funny observable that has 2.5 sigma deviation here. And in fact, that observable has also played some very interesting role recently in the Tevatron, if you heard about this TT-bar symmetry. So that, except for one observable, everything else agrees very, very nicely with the standard model. And indeed, you should not be alarmed by this tiny deviation here, because if you have 25 measurements, it's very likely that one of them will deviate more than 2 sigma from the expected value. So so up to date, there is no evidence that there is anything wrong with the framework of quantum field theory itself. It definitely works. So even though we're going to question a bit its current status, it's clear that it's correct in some way. Yes? That's right. There are 22 free parameters, but so the actual number of measurements that were done in LEP is millions of measurements, and they're all consistent. So in the end, I mean, there is a clear picture of what's correct and so on, and they've extracted 20 precision measurement observables that can be used to fit the parameters. But once you use these guys to fit the parameters in the standard model, you can use that to compute other things, and there are many, many consistency relations. So yeah. And also, many of these observables depend only on very few parameters of the standard model, and there are many, many internal consistency checks. So this table is a very famous plot from LEP that shows you how successful quantum field theory is. So even though quantum field theory is very successful and so on, and there is no doubt that it works in some sense, it's a very complicated framework. So if you combine quantum mechanics and the special theory of relativity together, you are inevitably led to study processes which have an unbounded number of particles in the external states. So you're bound to find processes like that where some particles decay to many, many other particles. And then you are essentially led to studying quantum mechanics with an unbounded number of particles. And that's a complicated theory. Quantum mechanics, many body systems with an unconstrained number of particles, it can become pretty messy. And I'm going to give you more examples of what it can lead to, such a complicated framework. So for example, you can have many, many spins which interact with each other in very complicated ways. And in addition, spins can pop out from the vacuum in various places. And you have to take all these processes into account. Sometimes it's manageable, and in some other cases, it's not very manageable. And I'll discuss extensively some examples and how they work. So this definition of quantum field theory as a many-body quantum system, which allows the creation and annihilation of particles, is very much particle physics or high-energy physics oriented. And I believe there are many physicists in the audience who are not high-energy physicists. And indeed, there are other definitions of quantum field theory, which at first sight do not look very equivalent to this definition that I use here. And these other definitions allow, in fact, quantum field theory to be very widely applicable in many other areas of physics as well. So I'll describe now some areas of physics that have nothing to do with high energy physics, but are also extremely well described by quantum field theory. So very much like this table that I showed in the beginning for how quantum field theory works well in high energy experiments, you can find similar tables of how well quantum field theory describes precision measurements in other areas of physics, such as statistical physics and condensed matter physics. So let me explain what I mean. So for example, if you think of example number one for another area of physics where quantum field theory is used and very successfully, so these are critical points of 2D spin systems. Ising model being the simplest example, but you can also think about POTS and other generalizations of this Ising model. And many of those fixed points are some critical points in statistical physics, and they're extremely well described by special quantum field theories in two dimensions that are known as minimal models. And these minimal models generated lists of many critical exponents, that some of which were measured before and some of them are not yet measured, but these are very precise predictions of quantum field theory for real life experiments. So this is another area where quantum field theory is applied very, very successfully. The second example are 3D statistical systems, so not 2D statistical systems. And about those, there is much less that's known because 3D quantum field theory is more complicated. But for example, we've seen applications for the 3D Ising model, that's from very long ago, for superfluid helium and so on. So the critical points of boiling, for example, the critical point of boiling water is described by the three-dimensional Ising model, and that all the critical exponents of boiling water can be essentially calculated using quantum field theory. Some of the exponents have been measured and they agree extremely well with what you can calculate using quantum field theory. So these are two examples where quantum field theory is applied. Another example is for systems that appear naturally in condensed matter physics, such as the Hall effect. So the Hall effect is famously described by a special quantum field theory that's called Chern-Simons theory. Many of the properties of the whole system are captured by Chern-Simons field theory, which is quite a subtle quantum field theory, but it does capture many of the known properties of the whole system very nicely. So that's another area, condensed matter physics, where quantum field theory is applied. It's the very same framework that's used in high energy physics, but it's arrived at from a different angle, from a different point of view. And if those are not enough, meaning statistical physics, condensed matter physics, high energy physics, if that's not enough, quantum field theory is so universal that it was even proposed that it describes quantum gravity in some special spaces, such as anti-de Sitter space. So we see that quantum field theory is sufficiently universal to even describe gravity, and gravity from the construction is absent in quantum field theory. It's absent in the construction of quantum field theory, but somehow certain quantum field theories can still describe quantum gravity systems. So these are four examples where quantum field theory is applied. To summarize, condensed matter physics, high energy physics, statistical physics, and even the physics of black holes. And that's very impressive. So for one framework of physics to be so widely applicable, and it's quite unprecedented, I believe. So even though it's so widely applicable and it's so successful, we don't really know what quantum field theory is about. So first of all, there are some symptoms of this fact that we don't know what quantum field theory is about. The first symptom is that we cannot really explain what is quantum field theory to mathematicians. So if you ever tried to explain what quantum field theory is to mathematicians, you would face a wall, because the quantum field theory does not have a rigorous, well understood definition from first principles. And many physicists, in fact, dismiss this issue, saying that, okay, this is the mathematician's problem, they're stupid, whatever, it's not our problem. But I think this is the wrong attitude. I think that we should take this fact that we cannot explain what quantum field theory is to mathematicians as a sign that we don't understand what it is. And indeed, historically, I think it's true that frameworks of physics that were well established and even less applicable than quantum field theory were in the end precisely formulated, and it was clear what they're about. This is not the case in quantum field theory. Despite many decades of work, it's very hard to define even free field theories in certain dimensions if you want to do it rigorously. So quantum field theory can be weakly coupled, and I'll explain what weak coupling means. But certain quantum field theories, they are weakly coupled, and there is then some kind of perturbation theory that you can apply. For example, the famous bump that we've seen recently for the Higgs, this is a CMS plot. So a bump like that can be calculated using essentially perturbation theory. So you don't need to understand quantum field theory rigorously, and so on and so forth. So you can do some kind of a more phenomenological approach of doing some kind of perturbation theory, and you can extract, you see, marvelous agreements with the data. And also these other computations that I have exhibited in the beginning that are like that. So sometimes quantum filters are weakly coupled, and then we can say a lot of useful things about them using perturbation theory. But also many, many interesting systems. In fact, I think more interesting systems than some weakly coupled filters, they are strongly coupled. And then we are essentially out of steam very quickly. We don't have any useful tools, general tools to attack strong coupling dynamics. Some examples to demonstrate that this problem is important is that strong coupling dynamics governs quantum chromodynamics, which is a theory that appears in the real world, and we're all very interested in it. Also in condensed matter physics, non-Fermi liquids, in statistical physics, boiling water, or even high temperature conductivity, they're all probably described by some kind of strongly coupled filters. And these systems are very important, they're very interesting, and we can say almost nothing useful about them because we don't know what to do with strong coupling dynamics. You see that there is this problem of solving quantum chromodynamics, or the closely related problem of solving Young-Mills theory, is in fact one of the celebrated millennium problems for which you can get $1 million. And it's a very nice problem, but in fact, one of the things that you have to do to get this $1 million is to prove that Young-Mills theory is well-defined. And that's another symptom that we don't understand what quantum field theory is. So in fact, it's not enough to solve the system. You have to first prove that it's well-defined. So that's another symptom of this general fact that the theory is not well understood and there is a lot of stuff to be unearthed. So how do we think about such complicated systems which are possibly strongly interacting? There are many body quantum systems with many, many particles that can pop out of the vacuum and then disappear into the vacuum and back and forth. So Mr. Wilson, long ago, had a brilliant idea, which is to divide by two. So to divide by two was not enough, so he divided by two again and again and again and again until it became so easy that even he could solve it. So how does it work? In fact, this set of ideas is extremely universal. It's widely applicable also not just in physics, and I will emphasize this point again. So the paradigm for how you do quantum field theory, mostly due to Wilson, this physical approach, you basically specify the rules of the game. So it's like a small computer game where you interact with your neighbors, and there are very clear rules for how you interact with your neighbors. Sometimes neighbors can appear and they can disappear from some cells on this game. And then what you do is you gradually zoom out. So you define the rules for how neighbors interact, and then you start looking for more global effects in this system. You start do what's called coarse graining. So you average out these small little rules of the game that you started from. You start averaging out, and that leads to a different theory. It can possibly lead to a different set of degrees of freedom or a different set of variables as you start coarse graining and averaging out over these small fluctuations. So at each typical scale, when you probe the system, there is some set of collective excitations or some set of degrees of freedom that you can usefully apply to describe the system. So for example, if you start with this example of some computer game where there are some interactions with nearing neighbors, so the rules are very simple. You would say that if a nearest neighbor exists, you give some weight 1. If it doesn't exist, you give some weight -1, and so on. And these are your degrees of freedom. These are these nearest neighbors. But when you start zooming out, the collective excitations or the degrees of freedom of the system can be radically different. They can be completely unrelated to what you started from. And I'll mention some examples of that. So these systems are very interesting, and you have to very closely monitor the set of collective excitations in order to understand the system correctly. So you start coarse grading, zooming out, and your collective excitations may completely change. They may have nothing to do with the collective excitations or the degrees of freedom that you started from. This is very common in strong coupling physics. If the system is weakly coupled, like in this Higgs example or the examples that people use to calculate in the standard model, then essentially the degrees of freedom don't change very much. These are the same degrees of freedom. Even though the rules of the game may be complicated, when you zoom out, these are the same degrees of freedom, the same rules of the game. Nothing drastic has taken place. But in some systems, even though the rules of the game for short distances and short timescales are very, very simple because there are so many particles, so many things going on at once, when you start zooming out, the system becomes extremely complicated in some cases. And sometimes this leads to a completely new set of degrees of freedom that had nothing to do, that has nothing to do with the degrees of freedom from which we started. So that's the general paradigm. So this is an example of what kind of stuff you can get. You can start from some theory, which is here called O, which is essentially a free theory. So this is a trivial theory where there are some simple nearest neighbor interactions, nothing fancy going on. And then you start zooming out. When you start zooming out, you can flow to many, many other sets of collective excitations. So these different letters, you can think about them as some sets of collective excitations. And some of these theories here, they're radically different from the spins that you started from, or from the free fields that you started from. And you can get very, very interesting and rich dynamics just from start by starting from some simple theories. So there are three basic rules for the game. These are the three commandments in this business. And they were given essentially by the god of this field, and you can try to guess who said whose commandments these are. So the first commandment is that the renormalization group is essentially the only way we know how to think about quantum field theory that is useful or semi-useful. And indeed, there is no point in trying to somehow solve the system ab initio using the fundamental degrees of freedom that define it. That seems excruciatingly hard, and there are no examples where it was done. It seems that this way of thinking, of zooming out, coarse graining, and defining some set of collective excitations at every scale is the right way to go. The second thing is that we do not, in many cases, you can show that some arguments based on the lowest order perturbation theory or some leading approximation completely and drastically fail. I hope that none of these people are in the audience because they got a Nobel Prize for a leading order calculation. But there are many amazing examples where leading order perturbation theory completely fails. So let me give you one example. You start from a theory of quarks, some fermions, and some vector fields. And these guys just interact weakly. Nothing fancy is going on. And you can try to compute the mass of the lightest particle or the lightest excitation. So you compute the first order in perturbation theory, you discover that the answer is zero. But and you would even think that perturbation theory is good in this system because the interactions are so weak, they're infinitesimal. But the magic of this many-body physics is that even though the interactions are infinitesimal, when you start including more and more particles and all this, you take into account all the effects of particles popping out of the vacuum, this infinitesimal number is multiplied by infinity. And so even though you would think that you should trust your leading order perturbation theory and the mass of the in the system, like the lightest excitation is massless, this answer is completely wrong. And this particular system turns out to be gapped, and there is no massless particle. And finally, when you try to define the collective excitations, you may try to do it in different ways. But in many systems, there seems to be some natural way of identifying this collective excitations, and if you don't use them, if you try to resist and try to do something else, you might be very sorry. Yes.
Regarding the second point, all the results that you showed for the why quantum field theory works are based on weak
That's right.
perturbation theory.
That's right.
And they
So
work.
that's right. There are many instances where perturbation theory gives the right answer, we think. But there are many instances where perturbation theory gives something which is completely off. And we think we understand the differences between the cases where perturbation theory should be applicable and it should not be applicable. We have some kind of diagnostic to understand when we should be using perturbation theory and when we should not. So there are some thumb rules, essentially, that tell you when to use it and when to not use it. Yes?
So there is something that feels contradictory here. Because on the one hand, you're saying that when you change the energy, you can change the degrees of freedom that you're talking about. One
Yes.
energy uses one degree of freedom, other energy uses another set of degrees of freedom. But then you want to write this a single equation, this renormalization group equation, for these different degrees of freedom. And the thing I don't understand is that how can you talk about a single equation for things that are very different. So, for example, we write our G equation for the coupling constant.
So I can give you an example, maybe a more physical example.
Yeah.
is, for example, if you wanted to describe some kind of flow in water.
Yeah.
So one approach, which cannot be dismissed, is to start from, you know, like 10 to the 24 electrons, protons, molecules, whatever it is, write this huge matrix of equations and just try to solve it. There is no doubt in anybody's mind, I hope, that this will eventually lead to the right answer, even though it may be excruciatingly hard. The brilliant insight is that if you're interested in some set of questions that are only sensible in some approximation, like, you know, when the fluid is well defined and so on and so forth, then you don't have to do this horrible thing of solving 10 to the 24 equations. You can identify essentially, let's see, 3 degrees of freedom, maybe pressure, temperature, and the equation of state or something, and that's it. And then you use general principles to solve the system.
And I'm perfectly happy with that. The thing that bothers me is that when you switch from one language to the other.
Yeah, so for example, in this language, you can ask, does anybody know how to derive the complete set of hydrodynamic equations for water, for example, including all the viscosity corrections, all the properties of water that you want to know? I think that everybody believes that there is one huge 10 to the 4 by 10 to the 24 matrix of equations that should lead to the correct properties of water. But I don't think anybody can do it. And the situation in quantum field theory is the same. We use some kind of trial and error or educated guessing to go from the huge set of degrees of freedom that we cannot control to guessing what are the correct degrees of freedom at the longer distance scale. So you see, these 10 to 24 molecules are replaced by at longer distances and long time scales, which is the hydrodynamic approximation, by 3 degrees of freedom.
That's my point, that the RG equation that you use for the fluid is not the RG equation that you would use for
But they're in principle the same. It's even the same thing.
But they describe different things.
It's true that they are slightly different technically, but the principle behind all of these things is the same. For example, it's even true in economics. In economics, if you want to trade in the stock market, it's clear to you what you do. You log into this website, you put some money, you get some money out, and so on. So you're like a player in the game. But there is the global picture, which emanates from solving for, I don't know, a few million people who are trading in the stock market. So it becomes a many-body system, which is very complicated, with many, many factors. And then you go from the variables that describe microeconomics to the variables that describe macroeconomics. And these are very different variables. But everybody believes that that there is an equation that takes you from one to the other. It's clear physically that if you are smart enough to understand in all detail all the effects of every single molecule and then solve the full set of equations, you'll be eventually led to the viscosity of water. Nobody can calculate from first principles the viscosity of water, but everybody believes it can be done through these RG equations. So this is the paradigm, and I want to mention a few cases where such dramatic transitions in the degrees of freedom take place. So I want to first say that many of the cases that I'm going to mention, these are not cases that were solved rigorously. So we cannot really solve all these RG equations exactly and follow the degrees of freedom and do it in all detail. In many cases, you resort to some kind of guessing or educated guessing. So one case which we are pretty sure about is a case where nature was kind enough to herself solve this model for us. And this is this theory that I mentioned where you could mistakenly do a perturbative computation and get completely wrong answer. So this is a theory where there are gauge fields and some fermions, and they interact extremely weakly with each other. You can see it in experiments. They almost don't interact. They look like free fields. This is called the Parton model. But once you start zooming out and you take into account these tiny little interactions, they start growing almost uncontrollably. And in the end, there is a huge transition in the set of degrees of freedom, like in hydrodynamics. And instead of describing the theory by fermions and gauge fields, the theory is described at long distances and long time scales, very much like in hydrodynamics, by protons, neutrons, mesons, pions. And these are completely different objects. And so this is an example where nature was kind enough to solve the model for us. There are some special quantum field theories that have extra symmetries, some, for example, supersymmetry. And these special models, in these models, we can say more about their normalization group equations than otherwise. And then people such as Seiberg were somehow imaginative enough to sometimes guess the right answer for the degrees of freedom. So there are no proofs for these guesses, but there is a lot of evidence that these guesses are correct. These guesses should satisfy stringent tests. They are not random guesses. And some people manage to make guesses that look correct for the degrees of freedom. And in these supersymmetric cases, we have examples where there are dramatic transitions between the degrees of freedom, very dramatic transitions. So we know that this kind of, we know that this idea of RG is probably correct. And it applies not just in physics, as I mentioned, also in economics and many other sciences. And we have examples where there are dramatic transitions in the collective excitations. So that's the state of the art. So here I just wanted to mention that this language of zooming out, coarse grading, is applicable not just in high energy physics or condensed matter or quantum field theory. It's also in thermodynamics and many other fields of physics. That's a point that I already made. And what I want to focus on today, so this was a review of the state of the art in some way. What I want to focus on today is some very general progress that took place in the last year or two, where people found new stringent constraints that are completely model independent on these RG equations. So I think that at this point, needless to say, we don't understand these morphs and these transmutations and morphisms of degrees of freedom. We don't have a good picture for them. But and so it's very, very useful to have general constraints or general understandings of what this kind of phenomena can do for us. So one thing is to understand them in detail, and another thing is to have some general constraints, perhaps, on what kind of stuff can happen. So for example, you could ask, can it be that in some model, I would have some set of collective excitations that is A, B, C? And you can try to answer these questions even without going into detail if you have general results about what kind of things quantum field theory can do. Yes?
Much of the success of renormalization group is because of universality
mm-hmm.
and the fact that there are always a finite number of relevance.
Mm-hmm.
Are there, I could imagine situations where that number is very large
mm-hmm.
and then it won't be very useful. Is that correct?
You're talking about the fact that so there are many applications to the renormalization group. One application is that if you understand one system, many other systems would look the same.
Right.
That's one application. That's called universality. So it's true that if you solve the Ising model, for instance, it pops again and again and again and again in many systems, right? So it's a very universal object. I'm not emphasizing this point today. What I want to emphasize today is that given a system which in which you know you have some degrees of freedom and they transmute in some complicated way, then there are some general constraints on what kind of transmutations could take place, what kind of morphisms of degrees of freedom could take place. It's a different subject. For example, in the Ising model, you start from a boson in some way. When the rules are defined, these are some spins that interact. So you can describe them by a boson that somehow boson that has some effective interaction. And then sometimes you flow to another point by this RG flow that looks like a free fermion. So the Ising model has a nice transmutation from a boson to a fermion in some way. So that's a simple example where, and so the idea is to try to constrain what kind of changes of degrees of freedom could take place. Given that there are so many radical changes of degrees of freedom, you may want to know what's allowed and what's not allowed. Okay, that's the emphasis today. So I will start with a little history. And the history is that people started considering two-dimensional quantum field theories. Those apply in very much in statistical physics and condensed matter, describing the Ising model, the Potts model, and many other interesting things. So people were thinking about two-dimensional quantum field theories in the 80s. So and they found that two-dimensional quantum field theories are such that for each quantum field theory, you can define some real number C. I won't explain how to define this real number, but you just imagine that somehow given a quantum field theory, there is a way in principle to compute some real number C. This real number C in some way counts the number of collective excitations. That's all it does. So if your quantum field theory is trivial, it's just a bunch of some bosons and fermions or whatever, you just add them up. And this is C. If it's a more complicated model, then C is a generalization of the notion of how many collective excitations we've got. So it just counts the collective excitations. That's what C is. It's some way of counting the collective excitations. And this number C is completely well defined in any two-dimensional model. Then this person, Sasha Zamolochikov, has shown in 86 that if you count the number of collective excitations in this way, just a second, then it's monotonically decreasing. That's what he proved. Yes. Okay, yeah, I'll just mention, that's right. Yes, I'll mention that. So what this person, that's true, that's a great question. I'll respond in a second. So what this person proved is that if you define properly the number of collective excitations, then it decreases monotonically. That's what he proved. So for example, you couldn't start with a model that had three bosons, and then some crazy strong coupling dynamics would kick in, and in the infrared you'd find 10 bosons. That's just inconceivable. That violates this inequality. And it's a very general statement. You see how powerful it is. It just says that there is no way, no strong coupling phenomena can create more collective excitations than the number we started from. And I'll mention in a second that nobody understands why it's true. There is no compelling physical picture that explains why the number of bound states or collective excitations cannot exceed the number of fundamental species that you started from. Now, let me just address the question that was asked here of how does this kind of inequality applies like in QCD. So first of all, QCD is in four dimensions, not two dimensions, but that's not important. The thing is that this inequality, this particular inequality that I wrote here, it's an inequality between the number of degrees of freedom that you use to define the system, you know, when you write it on the computer, just how many spins there are, whatever, at very short distances, and the number of degrees of freedom that you need to describe very, very long distances. So these are essentially the number of massless degrees of freedom. If you take QCD in its chiral version, then we can count. In the UV, there are 8 gauge fields and 6 fermions. And in the infrared, there are 8 pions, okay? So even if you add them up naively, which is not correct, you'll see that in the UV, there is slightly more in the infrared. Okay, so this inequality exists essentially for every energy scale, but here I just wrote its version that applies for the deep short distance limit and the deep long distance limit. Okay? Exactly. But this inequality also allows you to follow completely the RG flow throughout and measure the number of collective excitations at every scale in some correct way. And it holds in QCD in some sense, at every scale. But in this version, it just measures the number of collective excitations that are massless versus the number of collective excitations, versus the number of excitations that you use to define the system. Okay? So this is an extremely strong inequality. I'll mention some applications. It's an old result, and it enjoyed almost 3 decades of many, many interesting applications. So for example, people discussed black hole physics, condensed matter, statistical systems, and this inequality had very, very far-reaching applications in many, many areas of physics. For example, it can be used to constrain our ignorance about certain strongly coupled systems. It can be used to say something interesting about black holes, and so on and so forth. I won't list all the applications. There are thousands. we don't understand why there is this inequality. That's still an open question. I mean, there is no compelling physical picture that would explain why such inequalities should exist. And mathematically, for those of you who are interested in a bit more mathematical aspects of it, the fact that there is an inequality means that you can foliate the space of theories. So if you start from some rules at short distances and you flow to some other set of rules at long distances, there is no way to go back because that would be in contradiction with the inequality. So that just means that you somehow foliate all the possible theories by this real number C. There are also some extremely deep and very interesting connections between this number C and an object that is very much nowadays popular in condensed matter physics, which is the entanglement entropy of the quantum field theory vacuum. So one can prove, and this is something that there is a lot of activity on here in the Perimeter Institute, one can prove that this object C is very much the same as the entanglement entropy of the vacuum. So somehow you can interpret this inequality saying that the entanglement entropy of the vacuum decreases monotonically. And that may be the window for explaining why all of these inequalities are correct, in fact.
You don't say that it decreases
how would that work today?
So let me just comment on that for a second. So the simplest example that you can consider where this inequality is manifestly correct is that you start from some spin, and then you add the mass, and then the low energy theory is gapped. Okay, then the number of degrees of freedom at short distances is 1, and at long distances it's 0. So it's manifestly satisfied.
Okay, so you're saying that...
That was the motivation, that 1 goes to 0. But in fact, if you have strong coupling dynamics, it's not just that the number of degrees of freedom change, it's the nature of the degrees of freedom. You can go from fermions to bosons, from bosons to gauge fields. It's an utterly unrelated set of degrees of freedom. And there is no conceivable way I can see to give like a compelling intuitive picture why the number of bound states is not 200 in QCD, why it's 8. So, you know, in QCD, the number of bound states that are massless is 8, but why? Why is it not 200? I don't think there is a compelling explanation for that. Yes?
There's a famous example called the chromodynamics. For short distances, high energies is perturbative. For long distances,
sure.
Finding a strongly coupled. So you're saying that other degrees of freedom in the place we can't solve anything is smaller.
Exactly.
The place where we can.
Yes.
Why is this?
That's the second bullet point here.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. So a natural question to ask, in light of the fact that these developments by Zamolochikov in 86 were in 2 dimensions, a natural question to ask is whether such constraints also operate in higher dimensional models. If they operate in higher dimensional models, it would be interesting not just for QCD that was mentioned here a second ago. It would be also very interesting for condensed matter and statistical physics, because there are abundantly many models of statistical physics and condensed matter physics in 3 dimensions, for example, and even in 4. So having such inequalities in higher dimensions is very interesting. But first, we need a conjecture. We need to define a quantity which is analogous to this C that is maybe monotonic. So you need a good conjecture. And the good conjecture was indeed supplied in the 80s, shortly after this revolutionary paper by Zamolochikov, by Cardi. I hope this is Cardi, I've never met him. So he defined some quantity A in a way which is quite similar to the one that Zamolochikov defined, and he just conjectured very boldly that there is an inequality. The number of tests that he had back then for this inequality was meager. He just checked that it's true in QCD, that nature was kind enough to solve for us. He just checked plugging the numbers and just these stupid flows where you have some mass. And that's it. So that he really didn't have a lot of evidence for that, but he was bold enough to make this conjecture. Over the years, many people checked this conjecture in examples using gauge gravity duality that I mentioned, using supersymmetry that I also mentioned. And it appeared to be correct in most examples, except for a few counterexamples that were there. One was in 98 and the other one was in 2008. These 2 counterexamples took a lot of some years to be rebutted, but in the end they were rebutted. So there are no counterexamples at the moment.
So
okay, I'll discuss that, of course. This is for 4 dimensions. I also wanted to mention that this inequality has, again, some very deep connection to the entanglement entropy of the vacuum. That's, again, a subject that there are many experts in the audience here, and you can take advantage of that later. So this inequality is, again, saying something like that the entanglement entropy of the vacuum in 4 dimensions decreases monotonically, if this inequality is correct. So that's, again, a very deep connection that is not completely understood yet. Nobody knows how to take advantage of this connection to prove this inequality. So this inequality was established last year. So now we know that in 4 dimensions, indeed, this curious phenomenon that the number of collective excitations decreases monotonically is correct. We don't know why it's correct, very similarly to 2 dimensions, but it appears correct also in 4 dimensions. It leads to very stringent constraints on what quantum field theory can do. Let me give you an example of some kind of applications. So one application that would be interesting, for example, in some kind of phenomenology would be, given a quantum field theory that is strongly coupled, you may want to know whether some symmetry is broken spontaneously. That's a canonical question that you want to know the answer to in quantum field theory. You have a symmetry and you want to know whether the symmetry is spontaneously broken in the vacuum or not. So we can start from a theory that has some NF, so this is the number of species and gauge fields at Troy distances. So we have NF species of fermions and NC gauge fields. That's some kind of generic theory that many people are studying, for many, many different reasons. Now, you suppose that this symmetry, that there is some symmetry that relates these identical species, because they're identical, there is some symmetry that relates them. And one canonical question that you want to know the answer to is whether the symmetry that rotates this identical species is broken or not in the vacuum. So if it's broken, there is this Goldstone theorem that tells you that for every broken symmetry, you have a massless state. So you get NF squared massless states. You don't have to follow this algebra. It's completely elementary anyway. So what you end up finding is that in the microphysics, there are NF times NC states. And in the macrophysics, there are NF squared states, assuming that the symmetry has broken. And now, of course, there is an inequality. The disk gotta be smaller than that. This is what the inequality tells you. So the conclusion is that for any physical system at large enough number of species, you cannot have the symmetry broken. That's a rigorous theorem that you can derive without any work. Otherwise, we don't know of any way to prove that. It's an extremely non-trivial statement about quantum field theory that we have no idea how to prove. But if you believe this inequality, then it means that any system, once you have enough matter species compared to the number of gauge fields, then there is never any symmetry breaking. And there are many other applications of this type, that you assume that some phase or some dynamics takes place, you check the inequality, if it's wrong, then you resort to a different idea. Okay, so this is an example of an application that otherwise we don't know how to, we have no idea how to otherwise do this kind of stuff without such inequalities. So the next question that you may be interested in is, what about three dimensions? So three dimensions, four dimensions is interesting for condensed matter physics and for particle physics, but three dimensions is also an extremely interesting arena, because in three dimensions we have the Ising model, we have helium-4, we have many, many metals, and we have many, many theories that appear in nature. And we have Hall effects, the fractional Hall effect, the integer Hall effect. And so very recently, in addition to this progress on 4D, there was a lot of progress on 3D quantum field theories. There is no unifying framework that, you know, in one, you can explain in one way or in one, with one set of ideas, the progress in four dimensions, three dimensions, and two dimensions. But these things are somewhat disconnected, but they've taken place more or less simultaneously in time. So several groups, there are some pictures of the people involved, and you may recognize these two guys. So so recently there was a proposal that there is a quantity that they denoted F. So this is unlike C and A, it's denoted F. This quantity is, again, a real number that is defined for any three-dimensional field theory. There is a completely rigorous way to define it for any three-dimensional field theory. And they, again, conjectured boldly that this inequality is satisfied. There was some circumstantial evidence from a gauge gravity duality and from supersymmetric field theories, and they made this conjecture. Again, we don't know why this kind of stuff should be true, but it would, again, constrain the number of collective excitations in three-dimensional field theories. So as I mentioned, this conjecture would have far-reaching applications, if true, in many, many fields of physics. And the one thing about this conjecture is that, unlike these other two that I talked about, C and A, for this one, there is not yet a conventional quantum field theoretic proof. So there is a very nice argument by Mr. Cassini and Mrs. Huerta, where they use the relation of these quantities to the entanglement entropy of the QFT vacuum. So again, this F has something to do with the quantum field theory, with the entanglement of the quantum field theory vacuum. And these two fellows use this relation to argue very strongly or prove this inequality. So if you resort to some arguments from information theory that I'll review in a second, this inequality has been established. But one may also look for a conventional quantum field theoretic proof of this inequality, and that doesn't exist yet. So what did these fellows do? They used a property from information theory, and there are many, I assume that there are many experts in information theory here. They used the property that information theory is called subadditivity. So if you study the entanglement entropy of the quantum field theory vacuum, you have to specify a region which you want to measure and something else that you want to get rid of. This is how you create a density matrix. So what this inequality says is that if you focus on region A or on region B and you forget about everything else, you can define the entanglement entropies S of A and S of B. These are the von Neumann entropies for the density matrix that lives in A and B. Then there is an inequality that looks a bit like this triangle inequality that says that S of A plus S of B is bigger than S of the union and S of the intersection. That's a nice deep inequality in information theory. And the key thing is that it's an inequality. So if you are imaginative enough and persistent enough, you can show that this inequality turns into this inequality. And this is what these fellows did. They went, so I think this is a very deep result. It connects information theory with quantum field theory. So you can go from the entanglement entropy of the vacuum to something about collective excitations of in renormalization group flows. So now we have this nice connection, and such connection does not exist in four dimensions, but I think that people believe that it may exist also in higher dimensions. So there is no field theoretic proof using conventional tools of quantum field theory. But there is a proof if you use some properties of density matrix that are common in information theory. And that's potentially a link between two previously separate subjects. And that's very exciting, I think. There are many technical places where it has entered. For example, well, they use the properties of circle. So this picture is in three dimensions. So you take a two-dimensional slice. And this is the kind of object that you would like to concentrate on. So when circles intersect in two dimensions, there are very special properties of the intersections here. This is some cusp. And a lot is known about such cusps. And then they use, so it's under control. If you try to intersect spheres in four dimensions, you get higher dimensional singularities, and less is known about them. So it's in some way a technical obstacle, but it may also turn out to be a conceptual obstacle. I don't know. Yes?
So the definition of F, in principle, you can define it for different shapes.
Yes, it turns out that the correct shape is a circle.
But then the shape that you are defining there are not circles.
That's right. What I said, F is defined to be S of A, where A is a circle.
Yeah.
You want to prove that F for a small circle is bigger than F of a large circle. A large circle is like long distances, long times. And a small circle is like small distances, small times. So you want to prove that f of a small circle is smaller than f of a big circle. What these fellows have done is they've used this fundamental inequality that is known to be true in information theory, and they've used it iteratively again and again and again, in fact, infinitely many times, to go from small circles to large circles. Okay, it's a very ingenious proof, but I think the most interesting thing about it is that it connects previously the separate subjects. It would also be very nice. F can also be defined without reference to information theory, never mentioning entanglement entropy. As I also mentioned, also in two dimensions and four dimensions, C and A, they have some, you know, completely solid quantum field theoretic definition without talking about information theory. But they also have this dual interpretation in terms of information theory. So F can also be defined without ever talking about entanglement entropies or density matrices. But using that definition, which is more quantum field theoretic in nature, we don't know how to prove the inequality. We can only prove it using this relation. Yes? No. It's a property of any three entangled, if you have any three density matrices, four density matrices corresponding to the product of two Hilbert spaces, whatever intersection, then it's just a property. It's a kinematical property of density matrices that satisfy unitarity. Yes, that's what I said about the singularities. That in their they have a technical proof, and this only works in three dimensions so far. Below three dimensions so far. Yes. So what I wanted to emphasize is that in three dimensions, from my point of view, the story is very interesting, but it's not yet complete because we don't have a conventional quantum field theoretic approach to the problem yet. And there are also some, so There are some properties of the objects that appear in 2 and 4 dimensions, like C and A, that are completely well established and they're nice, but they don't seem to hold in 3 dimensions if you approach the problem from the direction of information theory. And so there are some technical open problems that the experts are very well aware of, and these are some small shortcomings of the story that will probably be resolved in the future. And also there are some pathologies with gauge fields if you try to define their entanglement entropy that are also technical issues that people will resolve. So in 3 dimensions, the story is not yet complete, but there's been a tremendous progress by these fellows and others. So let me summarize. So we have general inequalities, it seems, in 2 and 3 and 4 dimensions that concern with the collective excitations in strongly coupled many-body systems. Okay, these are highly non-trivial inequalities that pertain to essentially every quantum field theory you can imagine, and they all have curious connections to the entanglement of the quantum field theory vacuum. There are some tantalizing suggestions and recent tremendous progress on 3 dimensions. Also, many previously mysterious dynamical questions about what this and this model does are now solved. You can use this inequality, as I already hinted, to say something very concrete about some strongly coupled many-body quantum systems. You can use this inequality to say that the scenario that person X proposed in year Y is not correct because it violates the inequality, and some other scenario seems to be more plausible. And so we have, of course, these developments are nice, but they've opened even more open questions that I wanted to emphasize. So one open question is whether there are some constraints like this on many-body quantum systems that are not Euclidean or Lorentz invariant. Such systems appear in condensed matter commonly. I mean, not all the condensed matter systems are completely Euclidean invariant or Lorentz invariant. And such inequalities may or may not hold in such systems. And I think knowing whether there are such inequalities would be interesting for condensed matter physicists. That's one open question. Now, another question is, what is this entanglement entropy of the quantum field theory vacuum? It measures in some way how complicated, how tangled is the quantum field theory vacuum. And is it some order parameter? Is it a new order parameter for some phases of quantum field theory? Can it be used to maybe discern previously identical phases? What about renormalization group flows in 3 dimensions? I mentioned that there are some serious technical issues that still need to be resolved. And the most important question is, why do the collective excitations in quantum field theory obey these inequalities? I don't know of any compelling reason why they should. And I also wanted to end with some wild speculations. So quantum field theory describes, as we know, quantum gravitational systems. There is some duality between quantum field theory and quantum gravity. In this theory of quantum gravity, there are many emergent space dimensions that don't exist in the quantum field theory. These are some directions of space-time that emerge dynamically. They don't exist in the definition of the quantum field theory. So it's once you have a monotonic quantity, it's only natural to think about it as a new direction of space. Because if it's monotonic, if it decreases along the RG flow, it's like a new direction of space. It never goes back. It gives rise to a new affine coordinate on an auxiliary direction of space. So you can think that these quantities A and C, they can be closely related to the fact that there are new emergent dimensions of space-time. This idea may sound crazy, but in fact, if you look at some technical works that people have done in gauge gravity duality, you'll see that this is exactly what happens. These quantities decrease monotonically as you decrease the energy. And so there is a one-to-one mapping between energy and these quantities. And energy is usually thought to be the quantity that gives rise to these new directions in space in the dual gravity theory. And so because there is a one-to-one mapping, it's in some sense even true that these new directions of space in gauge gravity duality emerge because there is a monotonic quantity along the RG flow. Presumably, if such monotonic quantities did not exist, this would not make sense, this duality. Very closely related is the fact that in cosmology, we have some, you can imagine that there is some hidden theory that describes our universe, our gravitational universe. some other completely different quantum field theory that lives in a different number of dimensions, and we're just the manifestation of that object, and everything we see around us is emergent, including time. And of course, time is monotonic. It's the first monotonic quantity that you know when you study physics, and this is the direction in which the second law is obeyed. Time is defined to be the direction in which the second law is obeyed, and it sounds very much similar to this kind of stuff, because the second law is that, you know, related to entropy, and we just mentioned that the entropy decreases monotonically along the RG flow. So perhaps if there is a sense in which somehow there is some hidden theory that, and we're just an emergent phenomenon of this theory, maybe our time can be identified with one of those monotonically decreasing quantities. Yes. Yeah, I mentioned it briefly somewhere here, but yes.
So
it can be extended to a monotonic function of the energy. Yes. So in fact, you can think about, it may be possible that in some very precise sense, A or C or F, whatever is appropriate, would become what we call time. It seems very much like, it seems to have the right ingredients to be this object. And also in the context of gauge gravity duality. So that's where I wanted to end.
So we'd like to give students the first chance to ask questions. Are there any students that have questions?
Are there any articles where this relevant quantum field theory would not strictly be possible?
Those would not be called genuine energy flows, but sometimes, so you start from some theory that has no mass scales. So it's a nice scale invariant theory. Then you put some mass scale and you flow to another theory that has no mass scales. That's the canonical picture. Sometimes you can add some operators, special deformations that would not generate a mass scale. And then in this case, A would remain constant because there will be no real RG flow. There is no transient in the RG flow, and there is no crossover scale. So there are some very special tuned, if you want, flows that don't actually flow anywhere. So for those, A or C or F would remain constant. Yes? Yes?
Do you regard time as some kind of emergent direction, as some kind of A or F or C theory of this quantity? Then the 2-3-4 dimensions, time actually has slightly. So I'm saying that when we regard time actually in different
yes.
space time.
Yes, I wanted to mention something about that. Yeah. So the idea here is that time is an emergent concept.
Yeah.
Okay. So what you want is that there is some, what you may want to look for is some hidden theory for which is completely Euclidean. It has no time, it's just some statistical physics system, maybe even a matrix model. And that system, as you zoom out, so there are some degrees of freedom, but you can zoom out. And this procedure of zooming out and defining these quantities that are monotonically decreasing, this is what corresponds to our time. That was the idea.
But will you work the same in different space dimension? It seems like A and C and F are not the same quantity, right?
They're not the same quantity, but so they can all be defined in the Euclidean version of the theory. So they can be defined without reference to time. You can take a completely Euclidean statistical physics system in two dimensions, like the Ising model,
mm-hmm.
and you can define a quantity C that would be monotonically decreasing. So now we have a Euclidean theory, perfectly Euclidean, no time, and there is a quantity that monotonically decreases as you do something.
Yeah.
It's only natural to think about this as a new dimension, a new emergent dimension.
Yeah, I have no problem to think about this in different dimension, but regarding this, you know, I can arbitrarily take a slice of a space-time, then the quantity you define, does that match in the sense that if I want to consider, I just take a slice of two-dimensional space-time or three-dimensional space-time or four-dimensional space-time.
No, I'm not saying that this is a slice of our space. Our space would be regarded as an emergent concept. So you see, our time is just an approximate, what we call time is an approximate notion, what we call space may be an approximate notion, and the correct theory that governs all of what we see may be completely Euclidean.
Okay.
Any student questions? tonight we can open to my students.
Any comments about some claims that there are limit cycles, Lorentz invariant theories?
Well, there are many technical issues that I skimmed over very, very quickly.
But
you
those,
didn't even notice that I skimmed.
Are those claims correct according to you? Or? Because that would contradict this.
I see no point why I should commit whether they are there. There are. Right. There is a lot of debate now. Many of this, many generalizations of these things and many small small corners that were not investigated are now under scrutiny. And I don't know what will turn out of this. Like, there is a lot of work nowadays on this subject, and we'll know in a few years. Yeah.
Given that this inequality holds for C, A, and F, how would this help me solve the confinement problem?
No, I'm not claiming a solution to the confinement problem.
I mean, this is one example.
No, I'm not. What you can check is that this inequality is true in quantum chromodynamics. That's already good, because there are not many things we know that are true in quantum chromodynamics that are rigorous. So it's just something that's true about quantum chromodynamics. You can check that it's true. There are very few other things that are rigorous that we can check in quantum chromodynamics. It's mostly phenomenological. It's just true, and that's it. It doesn't prove that it's confined. It just happens.
You don't know how to solve confinement.
Oh, you're asking how would I solve confinement? I have no idea. Also about the other 6 millennium problems, I have no idea.
What's the use of this?
Well, you can use it to constrain the phases of different systems. So I can give you many examples. For example, in two dimensions, there are many, many critical systems of spins. And you may want to some condensed matter theorists, they like to turn on temperature. And then it may flow to another critical system. So when you know theoretically which flows are allowed and which flows are not allowed, you can build a theoretical model that encompasses all the phenomenology that you see. So it constrains which kind of RG flows can exist in nature and which RG flows cannot exist in nature. And in two dimensions, there has been a huge amount of applications. For example, in flows between various spin chains. This is something that condensed matter theorists would like put an order into. They would like to understand which flows between different spin chain systems are allowed and which are not allowed. And this C theorem is essentially an extremely important guiding principle. It tells you what is allowed, what is not allowed. And by now, this problem is completely solved. People know exactly which flows are allowed, which flows are not allowed. Everything is understood. In four dimensions, the story is similar. Many systems, you would like to know whether they break some symmetry, whether they flow to this system, where they flow here, if you turn on relevant deformations. That can also be important in the context of phenomenology. And having inequalities is just a general constraint on what is allowed and what is not allowed. And you can often use it very intelligently to get useful information. But it does not solve the confinement problem. That's for sure.
Too bad.
It's too bad, yeah. What can I do?
Any other questions? So maybe just to comment on this last speculation of yours. So are you suggesting that the cutoff of your quantum field theories are changing with time?
No, I did not say that.
But that's what that implies, right? Because
well, this idea, I must say, is not something new. The idea that time is emergent has been around for a long time.
But
right?
I guess you have a particular interpretation of time. You say
yes, that's what I say. Yeah.
And that interpretation has to do with the coarse graining scale.
Yes. So at some scale, if you probe what time means precisely enough, you may see deviations from the continuous object we're used to seeing.
So would you then agree?
Time is just a direction. How do we define time? Time is the direction in which the second law is satisfied. That's one way to define time.
But I think my point is that you have a more specific definition of time, which has to do with the coarse graining scale.
Yes.
It's related to the coarse graining
yes.
scale. So then should I expect the cutoff of my field theories to vary with time? Because this is a correct picture?
I think that if there is any physics beyond the continuous time that we see nowadays, it must be at pretty high scales. So maybe the framework that we're using nowadays is not affected by any of that.
But the only way for A to change is to slide the cutoff, right?
That's right. Well, let me give you an example, which is the gauge gravity duality, which you may or may not be familiar with. In gauge gravity duality, there is a new emergent direction from the field theory. The field theory lives in D dimensions, and the dual lives in D plus one dimensions. Where does the plus one come from? The plus one comes from the coarse grating, from this A. It's really one to one with A. So there are examples where A gives rise to a new direction. And of course, if you do experiments in this D plus one dimensional theory, which are, you know, refined enough or detailed enough, you'll eventually discover that there is no continuous notion of a coordinate there.
But in all the cases I know of, the emergent dimension is space-like?
That's right. In gauge gravity duality, the emergent dimension is space-like. What I'm proposing is something a bit more radical, that the Euclidean field theory can give rise to an emergent time. So there are two proposals here. One I think is essentially understood by people who do gauge gravity duality, and they agree that this is essentially what happens. But there is another scenario that I don't think there is a convincing example of. Perhaps, there are some matrix models that, Euclidean matrix models that are known to be dual to theories with time. So there are some kinds of examples of Euclidean theories that give rise to time. Yeah, but that's more radical a bit. Yeah.
But
in this proposal, wouldn't you have a preferred foliation of space-time? You want to foliate by constant A surfaces, right? And call those your time slices?
Maybe it's not a preferred foliation. Maybe it's a foliation reparametrization invariant. It's in fact also true. So I wanted to say one thing about it that I did not mention. In field theory, you can coarse grain, and you can find some monotonically decreasing quantity. But there is no unique way to coarse grain. There are infinitely many ways to coarse grain. And there is some kind of hidden reparametrization invariance in quantum field theory. That reparametrization invariance is called the renormalization group. It's not the flow, it's the group. So there is some hidden reparametrization invariance in quantum field theory that has very much the same structure as diffeomorphisms in general relativity. So it's very much likely that there is a diffeomorphic invariant formulation of everything in this period. Because quantum field theory has the right amount of redundancy to be compatible with the redundancy that we see in our universe. I mean, this Euclidean putative quantum field theory has the right amount of redundancy.
All the high dimensional examples.
The connection you mentioned with the integument entropy suggested to me an interpretation of these parameters, which perhaps is totally wrong, but I'm just curious. Does it make any sense to say that these things could quantify something like the information carrying capacity at a given scale? The amount of information I can sort of encode and expect to easily get out. Something that,
that's the definition.
Like, you know, if I store a bit on my computer in the magnetization of some object,
I think it
gets destroyed by thermal fluctuations, the information's still there, it's just at a microscopic level.
I think that the definition of entropy given by von Neumann or Shannon are very much precisely what you're saying. You can define them to be, in some way, the amount of information you can extract out of the system. So it's very much, in this period.
Does that angle on it suggest any ideas for why this property might hold and how to think about it?
I'm not aware of one. Also, if you look at the proof, so I told you that there is a formal proof going from this to that, but that proof is pretty complicated. There is no encompassing one simple physical idea. They just keep churning this subadditivity inequality again and again and again. So I think that there is some ideas that are missing.
Okay, let's thanks, Oregon.